Hello and welcome to Novara FM, brought to you by Novara Media and broadcast live on Resonance 104.4 FM, London's very, very finest radio station. I am James Butler and we are back. The long summer break is over and we're very glad to be back on the airwaves. And it has been an incredibly eventful few weeks in political terms. I think everyone listening will have had the barrage of notifications on their phones over the past few weeks, or maybe not if you're wiser than me and don't allow your inner life to be polluted by the constant nervous twanging of news notifications. But in any case, it's hard to avoid that there's been a huge amount of drama in the country. And joining me just to zoom out a bit this week and trace just what the hell happened and what will happen next is Aaron Bastani, my esteemed co-founder, author, broadcaster, scourge of wets and hammer of the melts.
Hi, James.
Just to say, if you've subscribed to the Novara Media YouTube, you know that we've been doing emergency broadcasts as these events have been unfolding. Those are still very much worth listening to or watching. You can find them on NovaraMedia.com and you can check out our other broadcasts, catch up on excellent article section as well. We will also be in Brighton very soon covering the Labour Party conference and its fringe event, The World Transformed. Every evening throughout the conference, we will be bringing you a broadcast featuring some big debates, and we'll have interviews with some of the most exciting and interesting speakers at the conference. And on Sunday night, we're hosting the Novara Media Radical Variety Show, where Ash Sarkar and Michael Walker will be hosting a veritable bedlam of top politicians, audience participation, games, and live music from Soweto Kinch. Tickets for that are just £3, so just come on down and see us there. And do say hi if you see us floating around.
Mm.
All right, I think we should go through a quick recap of everything that's happened over the summer break, especially in the last few weeks. As we were going into the summer, Boris Johnson had arrived triumphant as leader of the Conservative Party and new Prime Minister. There was a lot of talk in the press about his sinister and powerful media advisor and special advisor, data guru Dominic Cummings, former head honcho at Vote Leave. He's attributed, people talk about him as having this mastery of sinister digital political communications. And it was feared that this was going to be a kind of brutal operation that would, run rings around the old politics and build a terrifying Brexit coalition for the Tory party in the country. Reality, however, has had a way of biting back. We have seen, Cummings managed to come into number 10 and I think irritate just about everyone there. Came in saying, I'm going to crack down on leaking. Leaks, of course, have been enormous in the very short tenure of Johnson so far. And obviously there's been this kind of huge parliamentary drama as well. You've had motions laid to bind the government by the legislature. You've had resignations from Johnson's cabinet. Obviously, his brother, Amber Rudd, not people that you would think of as being remotely on the left, of course. And we have, of course, also had the drama about the suspension of Parliament, the prorogation, a long 5-week prorogation, which is, of course, now being tested in the courts. What do you make of all this drama, Aaron? Like, what's been significant about it?
Poor, that's a really big question. I'd want to highlight the fact that Joe Johnson isn't just withdrawing from the cabinet; he's actually withdrawing from political life. Mm-hmm. He won't stand as an MP again, which is quite significant. You know, if Boris Johnson's behaviour as Prime Minister has literally forced his brother to have a change of career. I mean, you know, that does speak volumes. In terms of what's happening in the drama, how does it relate to a broader political reality? I think this focus on Dominic Cummings is really important. And it mirrors to a certain extent how we see the media obsessed with Seamus Milne. It mirrors how the media were obsessed with Steve Bannon, even though actually, in reality, he only worked for Donald Trump for a very short period of time. He came towards the end of his presidential tilt. He was only there at the beginning of his time in the White House. And I wonder, what is it within the sort of the liberal psyche or the centrist psyche which makes people up as individual people behind the scenes who really wield power? I mean, it's going to take an intellect such as your own to write that down. But I do think it probably dovetails with a suspension in the belief of democracy, an inability to believe that masses of people actually determine history. So it does kind of default to this kind of Thomas Carlyle great man theory of history, doesn't it? And I think it's a very conservative way of looking at how politics and change work. That isn't to say he, you know, clearly the choices made by certain actors within a certain context will make massive differences. But yeah, this obsession with individuals and advisors at that, I think, is really telling about the broader political moment we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a media canard in some ways, you know, and it's particularly levelled. I mean, I think you're right to notice that there's a similarity with the way in which Seamus Milne, former Guardian journalist, but now Corbyn's director of communications, has been treated. But it seems to me especially applied to the Conservative Party, because if you remember, under Theresa May, Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill were treated as, because, you know, Nick Timothy, you know, not a conventional conservative in some ways, not from a kind of conventionally wealthy background, was treated by the media as if he had this sort of, you know, unbreakable insight into the psyche of the working class and those people that Theresa May needed to win, a kind of, you know, innate ability to reach out to what they need. And the idea was, and you saw it very early on in Theresa May's tenure, where people were like, you know, they're parking their tanks on Labour's lawn, you know, and so it always seems to me that you have this kind of this reaching for you know, the secret weapon of the Conservative Party. Very rarely seems to pan out.
They tried it as practice. Well with Steve Hilton, of course.
Yeah,
who was, you know, effectively was operating in the same role for David Cameron. Was there anybody like that with Gordon Brown? Not really. To an extent, there was with Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell, but that wasn't operating at the level of policy. And so I do think it's to an extent, it seems to be a sort of post-crisis confection. And I think it really does tell us something about changes and how establishment media it looks at the contours of the democratic process.
I mean, yeah, for me, you know, I do think the Cummings focus has been significant. I mean, the stuff in Parliament, I always think, you know, does it cut through? This is the kind of cliche that journalists ask, like, oh, well, no one really cares about what happens in Westminster. I mean, I think it does cut through on a level where, you know, people have a wider sense that there's some kind of democratic and political crisis. I think it can go both ways sometimes. I think people get frustrated with the sense that nothing is happening in Parliament. At the same time, it's very clear that the prorogation was not very popular, right? So suspending Parliament. I mean, I think people, when they hear the word suspending Parliament, don't react very well, other than a kind of small hardcore.
There was that YouGov poll, wasn't it? 27%
in support in the general populace. Much, much higher, of course, for people who support the Tory party, much, much higher for people who support the Brexit party. So you've got a sense, really, of a kind of base-building strategy maybe going on with that. But yeah, no, I mean, I think in terms of general significance, this stuff can be overplayed. But in terms of, you know, just the political dynamics, I think some of the stuff that's happened in Parliament, you know, passing these motions, again, not the first time it's happened, passing these motions to bind the government or to compel it in some ways, I think is really kind of, you know, tells something quite significant about the way in which Parliament has reacted to the Brexit process. We'll come on to talk, I think, a bit about the Constitution there. But one of the readings that's been, you know, given of the political strategy of the Conservative Party over this period is that what they really want underneath it all is that they want no deal. Right, so this is a popular line and it gets kind of trotted out all over the place, I think, especially by sort of centrist or liberal journalists. A lot of the kind of you know, ultra Remain faction, you know, they have this idea that any talk about a deal at all is you know, just disguising the fact that they actually are pretty happy about careening towards no deal. And you know, this is a very popular thing to say, of course, because people get very worried about it, and there's something kind of quite you know, exciting in some ways or alarming about this idea that there's this kind of you know, secret inner doctrine of the Tory party that they're going to head this way. Is it actually true?
Well, who knows? I mean, substantively, what we know is that Britain's preparations for no deal are far less than Ireland. In terms of, if you look at what's going on with just infrastructure changes to ports in Ireland, I think Cork is the outstanding example. You know, they are engaging with the possibility of no deal in a technical sense far more than Britain is. That said, Britain's clearly preparing for no deal in a political sense. Now, where the debate would lie is that some people would argue that's window dressing. Mm-hmm. Somebody like a Tom Cabassi would say that is about forcing through a deal with the help of 30 Labour MPs who do exist, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Who do exist. And it was the most plausible outcome probably a year ago. Mm. Amber Rudd, in her statement, when she resigned from the cabinet, said that, you know, Boris Johnson, rather than negotiating a deal with the EU, is spending all his time planning for no deal, which I don't think is true anyway. But as Michael Walker pointed out, this is like fantastic PR for the government.
Yeah.
And I think the reality is they're doing neither. They're not negotiating with the Europeans. Well, there's nothing to negotiate. There's no negotiating team to negotiate with. We can't negotiate with any single member state, which apparently is news to the British government.
It's news that they've been told many times and they forget this.
It was like the best example of it was, because it was in Yellowhammer. Yeah. They talked about this. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it was like 2 years ago, and David Davis says, we can negotiate, you know, a trade agreement with Germany. And he's like, that's not how it works. I don't know. You know, I'm on the left, so it's very easy for me to say they're doing nothing. It's falling apart. There's a kind of really weird ideological realization where you say, how the hell are these people in charge? Mm. For me, the sort of outstanding moment of that was when Boris Johnson was being asked about free trade, and he said that Britain could sell its beef to the United States, but we wouldn't have to import their beef, which is not how free trade works. So he wants free trade for our exports, but trade barriers and protections for our imports, which, you know, it's just stupid. So maybe he hadn't slept enough. Again, you can try and be charitable. Yeah, again, I'm on the left. I have my biases. I hope, you know, the audience should be aware of that. But I don't know. I don't think there are any plans, and I don't think it's being thought on at that level. I think right now it's very much chaotic. It's daily management, which is being conducted very much on an emotional basis, rather than some sort of grand strategic set of imperatives or calculations. So, I mean, we agree.
Yeah, I do think there's a kind of crisis management going on. I mean, I just do think that. You know, if you look at both Cummings and Johnson's records, you know, they're on record as saying, you know, that we, you know, they want a deal. Cummings in particular really, really hated the European Research Group, the kind of hardline no dealers, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Marc Francois, people like that, really, really castigated them. So I'm sure ideally that's what they want, but I'm also sure they're pretty relaxed about it going the other way. And I think really you're quite right to say that it's now operating, because so kind of rapid has been the political crisis that there's very little space to deal with much else in terms of, you know, the way in which they're thinking about it, particularly of the general election.
And can I say one more thing? Sorry. Given the state of politics since Brexit, since 2016, but generally since 2008-10, since the crisis, what kinds of personality types rise to the top, right? It's people like Dominic Cummings.
Yeah.
You know, it's people who will take risks. It's people who, pre-crisis, Dominic Cummings wouldn't have got anywhere near number 10. And so the idea that they're going to act in a rational, calculated way that would resemble what would have been just presumed until quite recently, I think, is incorrect.
I think that's true, and I think that's a nice piece to talk about. You have an article that's gone up on the Navarra website, and it's called, you know, just ensure I don't break Ofcom regulations here, F business, F the law, F parliament, the descent of British conservatism. And I think it's a really great piece, and it talks to a lot of these issues, right, about the way in which, you know, ideological change has taken hold of the Conservative Party. What is your sense of the way in which the Tory party has changed here? Because there's no question it's reinvented itself, or is reinventing itself under Johnson. I mean, what are the kind of contours of that?
I think it's now at odds with the sort of historic Tory establishment. Paul Mason talks about this in a piece as well yesterday in The Guardian. We probably wrote something, you know, more or less at the exact same time, because we realised the exact same set of variables were unfolding. You look at senior people in the civil service, the medical profession, education, the sort of the older patrician elite, the older landowning class. They must be looking at this and just thinking, what the hell is going on? You know, he's misled the Queen, for goodness sake. He's recatalyzed the conversation, probably a minor one, about republicanism.
Yeah.
The polling around Wales, 40% of Wales wants independence. It's the second poll that's shown it to be that high. I think that was yesterday. We don't yet have, or do we have, an absolute majority for Irish unification? That was that one poll. Again, it could be an outlier.
It's very variable, but it's close.
It may have been an outlier, but what was most interesting about it anyway was that amongst the young, there's you know, it's finding real favour. we've known that for Scotland, that was the case in 2014. Younger people tended to vote yes to independence. So, you know, I think if you're the older Tory establishment, you look at this and you see your world crumbling. I mean, F business, which is what he said. You know, this is meant to be the party of the business establishment. The CBI, you know, the CBI are more likely to back, I mean, they won't, they just won't, but they're more likely to back Jeremy Corbyn at the next general election than Boris Johnson. They certainly won't back Boris Johnson the next election, which is fascinating. They'll probably back a coalition government of like the Liberals and the Labour Party, I imagine.
With the Liberals is a kind of restraining. Yeah.
That's what I imagine they would do. So, you know, they're on a collision course with business, elite business interests. They're on a collision course with the judiciary and parliament, and they're on a collision course with just the rule of law generally. And you know, and the whole thing is, we were told for years, and I bought it, you know, I still buy it to an extent, because it's an entirely relevant and pertinent historical tradition. Burkean conservatism, parliament should be sovereign. And that's true. You know, if you live in a parliamentary democracy and that's how you conduct the democratic process, then power should clearly reside in parliament, because that's, if you're talking about popular sovereignty, if you're talking about how people are represented and how they wield and exercise power, that line is not perfect. It wasn't democratic for a very long time. It was autocratic, then autocratic, democratic, and then over the course of the 20th century became democratic. You know, that's a perfectly coherent worldview. And what these people would have said is, well, we need to restore sovereignty to Westminster in order to, you know, democratise the process. And that's a relevant and coherent thing to say. And on the left, you have this history of Euroscepticism, which is equally valid. But what we're seeing with Brexit and how it's unfolding now, taking on the judiciary, taking on Parliament, taking on, you know, anybody who disagrees, sort of the Liberal patricians, you know, as the enemy, the BBC. You know, I'm happy to criticise the BBC and its content, but the idea of a public service broadcast is brilliant. You know, I might think a certain judge is politically motivated, and of course some will be, but the idea of an independent judiciary is very important. And so I think there's a really big rupture going on with the Conservatives right now, and I said that they were going to... I think they're going to collapse, but they've, in a way, you know, our idea of collapse is overnight they disappear. They've had some strange transmutation going on really since Thatcher went anyway. And I think that before they quote-unquote collapse, or before they become something which is not continuous with the Tories over the last 100 years, something very strange is going to happen. And that might be a general election victory. I mean, I don't know. I'm not, you know.
I mean, right, there is. I mean, it's funny when you try to think about it, right, because it's not like the articulation of a new kind of conservatism, like the new right in France in, you know, a few decades ago. It's not a kind of, it doesn't seem to be a kind of particularly cohesive intellectual framing of it. I mean, you have, I mean, probably the strongest influence on Johnson's cabinet is the kind of group of MPs who wrote Britannia Unchained, which we talked about when it came out on the show years ago.
Yeah.
Now, this kind of, you know, Singapore of the North Atlantic vision, without Singapore's social provision.
Without socialising the land.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the really kind of strong desire to roll back workers' rights in particular. And so that's definitely in play there. But that's also not the kind of dominant theme, I think, of this kind of post-crisis conservatism. But in some ways, you know, when you think about it, there seems to me to be a couple of problems in terms of, you know, just the changes to the Conservative Party. Right? So you talk about this sort of Burkean tradition. You've got, you know, this kind of sense of moderation, restraint, the you know, contract between the dead and the, you know, not yet born. This sort of, you know, very expansive sense of what conservatism looks like. It's opposition in particular to like what Burke calls an armed doctrine, right? A real distrust of kind of systematic or abstract thinking, a fondness for tradition. That's all really very much out of the window now. And I mean, it has been for some time, right? And I think you can plausibly say, so one of the things that annoys me is when you get kind of historically minded people say, what has happened to the Conservative Party? It's like, well, this is, you know, this has been there, you know, rumbling along inside the party since 1979, at the very latest. You know, and I think there is something special about 2008 and then the kind of Brexit vote itself, which is that you have this question about the relationship of individual conservatives to kind of big structural economic issues, and they're ones that pull different parts of the Conservative Party in different ways, right? That's part of what's going on here. I mean, you know, the Duke of Westminster, resigned from the Conservative Party the other day. This guy is like the owner of like most of central London.
Is he the richest under 40-year-old in Europe or something? I need to check this out. But he's quite young, isn't he, basically?
He is. His father died recently and he sort of acceded to the position. But yeah, so you have that kind of fission going on within it. And, you know, like the Tory Party is very good at keeping itself together, you know. But whether it can survive it is to me to you know, an open question. But there are two other things as well, right? And it's a longer story. There's just the impact of mass suffrage on conservative projects, right? Now, the Tory Party doesn't have an internal democracy, really, in the same way that the Labour Party does. I mean, the Labour Party's internal democracy isn't perfect either. But it has moved, and this is something that the Labour Party theorist Richard Crossman observed in the 20th century, is that the creation of the Labour Party and its internal democracy changes the way the Conservative Party thinks about itself, right? It thinks of itself much, much more as a kind of mass membership organisation. It thinks of itself, you know, it reforms itself while the other party changes itself. But you have now in the Conservative Party people who really do think they should have a say over the direction of the party. Now, in the past, that has been like relatively muted. Now it's definitely a lot stronger, right? I mean, you had certainly under Theresa May's leadership, you know, rumblings from conservative associations that they were going to rise up in insurrection. They never really arrived, of course. But as you say, going alongside that, there is this weird kind of post-Thatcherite, you know, attempt to find something to reinvent the Tory Party with, right? So you've got like Ian Duncan Smith, William Hague, Michael Howard doing like all these kind of variations on social authoritarianism, which just doesn't really work. David Cameron comes in and sort of reinvents it along the lines of kind of patrician Notting Hill Toryism. And Theresa May tries this kind of authoritarian,
which only gets the majority in 2015.
Right. I mean, it's much less electorally successful than people kind of think in memory, right? Mm. Theresa May comes in and does this kind of authoritarian Christian democracy thing. It doesn't quite work either. And part of that is because of the way in which the Labour Party changes in that time. And now there's this thing, which is much less cohesive, kind of much, you know, much more sort of toxic. So I wonder about like the way in which these things can be held together, and particularly with the kind of political pressure of Brexit running alongside it.
I mean, conservative associations were very vibrant sites of civil association across the country for a very, very long time. The Conservative Party had a far larger membership than the Labour Party, although, of course, still significantly smaller than trade unions. You know, you're looking at millions at the midpoint of the century. But the people that were participating in those conservative associations, like I say, that wasn't born of a democratic impulse. That was born of, do you want to get ahead in life? Do you want to get a promotion at the job, you know, at the local, you know, where you work? You know, do you want to be the foreman somewhere? Do you want to be, you know, be elevated above a clerk? You would join the local conservative association. You would know certain people. It was a way of lubricating your progress in life because of the thick social ties it created. That is just nowhere. It's nowhere. And what they became over the 90s, the noughties, was basically drinking clubs for the over 50s. They did. And that's fine. Those people, we'll be over 50 one day. We'll want that. You know, that's fine. You know, but that's clearly a desiccated version of what it previously was. You know, it was very much a vibrant organism for association for all kinds of people from all walks of life. And even what it then became is sort of no longer there. On the other hand, and this is why we shouldn't necessarily assume it's dying, I don't think it can command a social majority, but I also simultaneously don't necessarily think you can write it off. It's because I suspect that societies determined by very low growth, determined by precarity and underemployment because of automation, which are increasingly old, will become quite authoritarian. And by the way, those factors will afflict pretty much every society in the world. And we have to understand that in terms of how resources and advantages allocated in society, necessarily it will go to older people because they've been around longer, of course. But the point is, because of falling birth replacement rates, because they're living longer, that's going to change society in all sorts of ways. Somebody in their 20s, 30s will be more liable to change their minds over an issue than somebody in their 70s or 80s. Again, that's not an ageist comment. And yes, people in their 80s can change their minds. But quite rightly, you've been around for a certain period of time. You think you know what's what. And so I think as a civilization, you know, we've never had the old outnumber the young as a human civilization ever. You know, go before the Neolithic Revolution. Go back 200,000 years since people have been walking around the African savannah broadly with, well, no, actually with identical brains to you and I, right? We've never had to work out how to run a society where the old outnumber the young. And now we're going to have to work out how to do that. And I suspect one feature of it will be very strange quasi-authoritarian politics, which is a challenge for the left.
Yeah.
Because we always say, well, the young think this, and we just said about Ireland and Scotland, and the young like Corbyn, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that doesn't matter because they aren't necessarily the future, because those people who are 60 today will still be voting in 30 years when they're 90, because that's how long, you know, elderly people, as long as they're not poor, because they die around 65 in most British cities, that's how long they'll be living and that's how long they'll vote for.
Yeah, I mean, just, on the flip side of this, of course, is that, you know, you can win pretty big in British politics without a social majority, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this may be one of the calculations going on in the Tory party at the moment, right? If you can cohere about 35% of the vote across the country, you're probably going to be fine. It's not going to be comfortable.
Well, there's a few variables, right? So they're going to lose 13 seats in Scotland.
Yeah.
Right now. That's how it looks. They may not, but right now. So if you lose Scotland, you struggle in Wales, which I think they actually do okay in Wales, but I think long term, I think Labour and the Tories have problems in Wales. You know, I think that's hard.
Yeah.
And I think that what makes the whole, what makes predicting the next general election is that in most seats, it will not be a four-way marginal, but there'll be four competitive parties, the Lib Dems, the Tories, Labour and the Brexit Party, maybe in half the country's seats. So, you know, that 35% thing, equally, you could get 25% and get like two or three seats.
So it's going to be a democratic nightmare, right? I mean, that's one of those things that is kind of a slow ticking time bomb under like the structure of British democracy. I mean, the other thing, of course, is that, the Miliband leadership pursued a 35% strategy.
Oh, halcyon days. This is before the collapse in Scotland, of course.
And that didn't really work out. I mean, just to say, like, so the flip side or the other argument in the piece you write, I think, which is, I think, on people's minds because of the way that things have gone over the last few weeks, is that, and it's weird, right? The constitutional questions in Britain, which, to be honest, have never really been at the forefront of political debate for the past 50 years. They've received attention like never before in this period. And the attention has been like sometimes kind of procedural and geeky and like, wow, this weird institution. But at the same time, like you detect this kind of sense that people are feeling like these institutions aren't really working very well. My question in some ways, so in Britain, like, the thinking about the constitution has usually been the preserve of the right? Partly because of its nature. You know, it's got all this kind of feudal archaism. It's got the kind of the really weird procedural arcana. It's kind of, you know, in a kind of gold, you know, there's a big gold throne at one end and there's, you know, all this kind of bizarre ritual at the other. In that sense, if you think about the way you think about politics, probably naturally attractive to a small c conservative mind, right? Maybe people who are attracted to rules geekery as well. And it's so much a part of the way that people think about the British Constitution, it's very easy to slip into kind of conservatism when you think about it. For the left, I think there are things that are much more attractive about, you know, Republican tradition, the kind of tradition that emerges in France or, you know, after, you know, various, you know, revolutionary polities. But are there, do you think, you know, and bearing in mind that there are these kind of huge and, you know, constitutional questions, you know, running around at the moment, do you think there's something kind of valid and important to protect or preserve in British democracy? What do you make of the kind of, you know, rankling constitutional crisis?
I understand the arguments for an uncodified constitution. And there is a really strong argument that it actually is very effective. And the idea of, you know, no parliament binds another. Parliament is sovereign. However, you know, that in that case, you can't have referenda. Right, because the referendum of 2016 is clearly binding following parliaments. Clearly, parliament isn't sovereign if all of a sudden this directly democratic will of the people supersedes its sovereignty. So it's coherent, but I just think it's so completely at odds with people's expectations. You know, this is going to sound very trite, but you would vote for, you know, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. People engage with voting, all that act, that democratic act, all the time. That people, the customer's always right. There's an ideology of the centered around the individual, often deformed within sort of capitalist realism, but very much, you know, people have agency. I mean, the great thing about Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism, is that people feel they both have, you know, this incredible agency to transform their life. You can be whatever you want to be, but at the same time, nothing really changes. You know, you can't change society. Politics is a waste of time. And that's an interesting alchemy that's at the heart of sort of capitalist realist ideology, premised on anti-utopianism at the social level, at the same time believing in an almost alchemical way anybody can be anything they want to be, which is clearly absurd. So I think substantively we should have a written constitution. I think clearly we need to agree on the rules that we're playing by and can appeal to. Does that mean we imitate precisely what there is in the United States? No. Would I like a president? Probably yes. Would it look like the US president? No. It would look probably more like the Italian president. So there's somebody who's acting as a check on the executive. They're chosen by legislators, but it's not the Queen. So I can imagine a president like we have in Ireland, for instance. I think there's even a president in Germany, isn't there? There is. I think. There's somebody above the Chancellor. And of course, you have the president in the Italian system. You know, that is a very different way of organising things to how the president works in France and the United States. They exercise huge executive function. The president in France effectively is meant to be the king. That's basically what they're... Look, this is kind of a good way to run society. France worked back then. This is going to be basically the same kind of social function. So, you know, I would like to see a presidency. I would like a written constitution. I would like electoral reform, an elected second chamber, and radical devolution. However, I do agree with certain criticisms which say you can go too far down that route of a codified constitution and imitating the US or France, because there are problems in any kind of polity. But that doesn't mean we don't change a single thing about Britain, because again, it appeals to anti-utopianism. Yeah. Clearly, this isn't working. A set of gentlemen's agreements from the 17th century isn't working.
Yeah, I mean, it's so startling in some ways that, you know, obviously I probably quite unusually on the left think about the, you know, constitutionality quite a lot. You know, I started thinking about it actually a few years ago when I was thinking about kind of, you know, France's emergency law and the way in which, like, the left kind of abandons that sort of legislative space and it doesn't really think about it. Partly because the left has always tended to treat, like, the way in which constitutions happen as this kind of, like, excrescence that happens because of, you know, material relations somewhere underneath it. I think there's something plausible there, but I do think it's important to think about this stuff without being, like, assimilated to the institutional logic itself. You know, there is quite an interesting and strong tradition in Britain of thinking about the operation of Parliament and the operation of British democracy in quite a sceptical way, right? This is what Badgett does, right? This is the most famous constitutional writer, Victorian constitutional writer. And funnily enough, that then, like, you know, people adopt the things that he says about Parliament rather than the method of scepticism, right? Thinking about the way in which actual political forces work, you know, underneath kind of the formal structure. And I do think you're right to recognise that there is this kind of tension now between, you know, referendum-style democracy and the kind of iterative, processual democracy that Parliament kind of wants to achieve sometimes, doesn't often manage to achieve it in particular. I mean, I guess the flip side of this also is, like, and you know, what worries me in terms of this stuff on the left, and sometimes some of the rhetoric that's come out of the Labour Party when it's been talking about Parliament in the last few weeks, is that you know, I do think, and you said this earlier in the show, I do think it's important to be able to claim and to make the political argument that the neutrality of the institutions is not always in fact neutral, right? And I think it is important to claim that naturally, you know, that there will be ideological forces in operation in the judiciary, for instance. I mean, you know, the way in which magistrates in particular, I'm not talking about high judiciary here, you think you get a bit lower into the judicial system and you think about, you know, okay, well, the way in which, you know, the judiciary thinks about good character, the way in which it thinks about, you know, life prospects, the way in which it you know, meets out, you know, really often very unequal punishments. I think all of that's very important to bear in mind. And I think the left should be making claims about that. The same kind of claims you can make about any institution that appears neutral, right? You know, Bevan talks about, you know, when you know he writes an essay for young MPs going into Parliament for the same time. He talks about Parliament as this kind of great social shock absorber. That's the kind of word he uses, where you kind of presented one with this kind of weight of tradition and symbolism that kind of just sort of squashes you down. And he says, you know, the people they're talking about here, these kind of great parliamentary heroes, not your people, right? He's talking to a Labour MP going into the chamber for the first time. They weren't necessarily. I worry that the left can sometimes fall back on arguments which are more properly the arguments of sort of the liberal centre, which are arguments that get deployed against Trump quite a lot about norm erosion, right? That the bad thing about, you know, Johnson or Trump is that they, you know, shatter or are in dereliction of kind of democratic norms. And to a certain extent, of course, that's true. But, you know, I think it's important to keep in the mix that norms are things that encode certain settlements, that they can and should, frankly, change. I mean, surely no one can look at the way in which Parliament operates at the moment and say, this is what we want to protect, right? Nothing should change about it. There are really good things about it, of course, as well. I mean, you know, that, you know, one of the strong arguments on the left about, you know, the historical accident of Britain's Parliament is that it has kind of enormous power, right? If you want to remake the country, you can have pretty much, if you have a good majority in the House of Commons, you have pretty much a whip hand to make the country change in the way you want. So one of the things that, of course, is miserable about, you know, the record of the Blair government is that, you know, the opportunity to really fundamentally reshape Britain was there, and to a very large extent, it wasn't taken.
And also, I mean, it's not just Parliament that needs to be subject to reform. You know, we need to talk about things like the Privy Council. So in the Netherlands, I'm not quite sure what it's called. I think it's the Council of State. Is it called the Council? Yeah, it's the Council of State. I was going to say the States Council, but I mean, whatever, same thing. The Council of State, which is effectively sort of fills the same procedural role, but it expresses all the parts. I think basically most of the parts in Parliament are represented to some extent. Mm-hmm. You have some sort of senior civil servants. There's the chair of it isn't actually the monarch, or they are technically the head of it is the monarch, but technically the vice chair is the person who basically leads the procedures, and they're not the monarch. So, you know, even if we don't go full republic, surely the idea of a Privy Council, which, I mean, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the Privy Council meeting between the monarch and the prime minister, which prorogued Parliament, Jeremy Corbyn wasn't even at that. Is that correct?
No, he wouldn't have been at that. And the one of the reasons...
We say he wouldn't have been at that, but it's such a huge decision that...
Yeah.
He could have been at it, couldn't he? If Johnson wanted him to be.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been theoretically possible for him to invite Corbyn there. I mean, here you enter into kind of complex questions about, like, you know, constitutional conservatives would say you don't want the Queen in a situation where she might be presented with conflicting advice, or even like an argument happening in front of her, right? And so you want a kind of, you know, unitary form of advice to go to the Queen. I think the Privy Council exists, but in practice it tends to be composed of the ministers of the cabinet, right? So the active part of the Privy Council. And that's not to say, of course, Privy Councillors also receive, you know, various briefings in kind of greater...
Because technically Jeremy Corbyn is a Privy Councillor,
but he just wouldn't attend these meetings.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the opposition, the leader of the opposition is always a Privy Councillor, always made a Privy Councillor. So I agree, and I think, you know, reform of the Privy Council is absolutely important. I just think, you know, the other thing that has been kind of, you know, weighing on my mind when thinking about this stuff is, like, you know, that yes, there's danger of being sucked into deference to the institutions, but, you know, one of the things about the democratic crisis recently, has been, you know, and I'm talking, you know, more widely here than just in Britain, you know, has you get an appreciation of institutional value, not necessarily actually existing institutions, but the way in which institutions are important in restraining political violence, for instance, and that they provide in some cases an avenue for democratic political change. And some on the left will say that this is kind of merely like an illusion, right? So that actually, you know, it's a form of deceit, and it neutralizes any possibility of political change. And I think it tends to be, and it has to be, and it is inevitably the terrain on which politics is fought to some extent in liberal democracies, settled kind of liberal democracies. You know, it's kind of a Gramscian point. But yeah, I mean, I fully appreciate that the House of Commons presents kind of unequal forces in a display of kind of false equality, right? So, you know, you've got formal equality in the House, you've got one person, one vote, you know, in terms of the electoral system, those votes are unequal, they're not counted equally. You know, that kind of formal equality becomes a substitute for like further reaching economic and political equality. Anyway, let's move on from the institutions. I don't want to talk about the institutions all show. Political struggle in a few weeks, mm-hmm. in the next few weeks. Parliament is prorogued, nothing's happening there. People will be relieved, they don't have to watch like, Parliament live for hours on end.
And just to confirm, because you are Navarro's resident constitutional expert. Of course, we had what happened with the Scottish judges the other day. Mm-hmm. They made their judgment. You don't think that changes anything in terms of Parliament suspension?
I don't think it will. The court could have given an order. And it didn't, so right. because it knew that it was coming to the... So this is the case that was before the Court of Session in Scotland, and the judgment was that the prorogation, and because of the advice that was given, because the kind of advice that was given was, one, justiciable. I mean, so the this specific thing could be brought before the courts. The English High Court said, no, we can't touch it because it's a matter of high policy. These are two kind of slightly different ways of thinking about constitutionalism. The Scottish Court said, yes, it is, the nature of the advice given and it makes it justiciable. And so those two cases together, the one that was brought in England about prorogation, the one that's brought in Scotland, it's going to go to the Supreme Court on Tuesday, on the 17th. The court is sitting for 3 days and you get a decision there. Honestly, quite difficult to tell which way that decision is going to go. That's quite a good thing in a Supreme Court to be able to tell that, not to be able to tell which way it's going to go. There will be interesting things here about how you reconcile the English and Welsh court's position. Right, so the High Court's position, which is that can't touch these things because it's a matter of high policy, it's a matter of Parliament. Bill of Rights says you can't bring proceedings of Parliament or high policy before the courts. Mm. The Scots courts, it tends to be kind of, it doesn't have that kind of so absolute a way of distinguishing in the way it thinks about the Constitution. So they say, you know, this kind of the advice on which, or the kind of, you know, the way in which the prorogation was brought about makes it a matter that can be brought before the court. So that's going to go to the High Court, the Supreme Court now, and we'll find out, I guess, this week which way it's going to go, this coming week which way it's going to go. And then things could be interesting, right? If the Supreme Court decides that actually, the prorogation was unlawful, then things could get interesting.
So would Parliament go back into session, or
could do?
Because we've got conference starting on 22nd?
Yeah, but by the time this is all over, I mean, we're going to be nearing the end of conference season, right. I think. It may be something of a fait accompli, but I mean, it's going to be a political headache for Johnson in some ways, right? Because you know, the thing that they wanted to do, really, the thing the Conservative Party wanted to do in this period was to, you know, Parliament isn't active, so you've got, pretty much a free media space. You just use the advantage of being in government to really start pushing things that make you look good for an inevitable election campaign. Mm. That was what they wanted. You know, earlier this week, there was going to be like a big announcement about warships being built. And that just got pushed completely off the agenda by this stuff. That's not to say that the media game is taken care of, you know, in terms of the Conservatives not getting things their way, but I mean, it is going to be, it's not the ideal situation for them, actually. This was supposed to be a big space where they could take a run at things, and it doesn't seem thus far that it's working out for them that way. For that to remain the case, obviously, these things are going to have to be, you know, continually pushed. You know, last night, for instance, John Bercow gave a lecture, the Bingham lecture, on the rule of law, and he said two very interesting things. He said, you know, I will undertake more creative procedural innovation in order to allow Parliament to stop the Prime Minister if he intends to break the law. Mm. It's really significant for what's going to happen in the next few weeks. He also said, you know, on some of the things we've been talking about, he said that he has moved towards favouring a written constitution. And that is a less dramatic headline, but it's actually more startling in some ways. So with that in mind, what do you make of the way the Conservatives are going to use this period, right? What's and how have the media been reacting to the Conservative attempt to kind of effectively run an undeclared election campaign?
Well, they have a major problem, which is that Boris Johnson can't do what Jeremy Corbyn does, which is actually talk to people.
Yeah.
He can't actually have any contact with
it's
the public.
It's astonishing.
Yeah. I mean, that's because that will just determine the headlines, yeah. Right? So they somehow have to run a campaign where he doesn't talk to people in a manner that is reminiscent of Theresa May. The difference being that Theresa May never sold herself as a populist. Mm. She never said she had the common touch, whereas Boris Johnson does. So it's going to be very, very difficult for him to execute both a strategy over the coming weeks, but also during any prospective general election. So how will they manage it? Yeah, you've got the big policy announcements, but I just don't think they do. I think the Tories are in really, really big trouble. You know, that's not being borne out in polls, whatever. Boris Johnson is not going to stand in Uxbridge. So if you've got an MP who's got a majority of 5,000 who's not going to stand, things are pretty bad. Mm. And I think the Brexit Party would do very well. However, I don't think they'll get many seats. You know, if they do get any seats, they're going to be in very strange places, which are Labour seats, like Bolsover, Barnsley. If you look at the extent to which these places voted for the Brexit Party in European elections, it's frightening. Mm. But the Tories, I think, are in trouble, and that's going to impact their media strategy in the coming weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the democratic question that would come out from an election that turned out like that, you probably have the SNP sweeping quite a lot of Scotland again, mm. on probably a smaller vote than the Brexit Party gets nationwide in that election.
Yep.
And then if they get only two or three MPs, then there's like this kind of very big constituency, a kind of social constituency for like really, you know, deep sense of the illegitimacy of Parliament. So I don't think in some ways some of the problems we've seen over the last few weeks are going to go away.
No.
In that case.
And I also think that, you know, we have to sort of restrain our belief in what the Brexit Party could do. Could they get the 4 million votes that UKIP got in 2015? Look, by doing that once, Nigel Farage probably proved himself to be the most capable Conservative politician of his generation. If he can do it twice with two different political parties, that's really, really impressive. So they got what, 15%, I think, in 2015 or 12%?
12.6.
Yeah, okay, 12.6. It was just shy of 4. It was like 3.8 million or something like that. That would be the ballpark figure they would want. That would be their low estimate, mm. I reckon. If they get above that, then things are getting really, really odd.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, we're going into conference season now. The Lib Dem conference is starting down in Bournemouth. Jo Swinson has given an interview where she's like, Philip Lee's homophobia, actually very nuanced.
Mm.
Going to come back and haunt her.
Mm.
I'm going to make sure it comes back and haunts her.
Well, it's not just his homophobia.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's not just it's his racism, it's his bigotry, but also, if you look at his voting record, on every single issue, he is entirely at odds with the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah, it's really
stunning. Votes
to
16,
yeah.
Elected House of Lords, bedroom tax. Well, actually, they abstained on that. Let's not talk about that one. But all the constitutional stuff, changing the voting system.
Yeah.
He voted, I think, against bankers' bonuses 15, 16 times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he in no way is a Liberal Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite startling, isn't it? But I mean, I don't really foresee anything significant coming out of a Liberal Democrat conference this weekend unless it's a slip-up of some kind, right? There's not going to be a startling policy change. There's not going to be anything kind of surprising.
Well, did you hear Jo Swinson's... I heard it was clipped up yesterday. I don't know if it was from yesterday, where she said liberalism is alive and kicking. Did you hear this?
I didn't, but I mean,
talk about delusional.
I mean, the thing that she's saying actually is very much, and this was clear in her interviews today, the press round that she did today. She's like, left and right is over. It's about liberal and authoritarian. So I think that's really, you know, going to be a continual theme, and it's one worth pushing back against. But, you know, by convention, parties don't announce major initiatives during each other's conference. So I think, therefore, we can expect the Tories to attempt to wreck the Labour Party conference sequence. That would be very attractive to someone like Dominic Cummings. God knows what they'll actually do there. But what's your sense of what... Because Labour Party conference is not like the other party conferences, right? It decides policy, at least nominally.
Mm.
It is at least nominally sovereign. There are all sorts of problems with that that aren't, you know, make it not actually true. Great degree of parliamentary autonomy, for instance. What's going to be decided there this year? Is there a big, big Brexit bun fight coming?
I don't think so. I think the Jeremy Corbyn position that's been outlined in the last week has been surprisingly wide in the praise that it's attracted. You know, Keir Starmer, I think, is effectively behind it. People talk about this split. I was talking on the Sky podcast yesterday, Adam Bolton's podcast, And he said, Tom Watson obviously made this intervention. Is there a bit, you know, is there a split in the Labour Party? And that's the narrative that the media have adopted for 2 years. Is there a split between Tom Watson, the PLP, and Jeremy Corbyn and the extra parliamentary membership? No. And I think the response to Tom Watson's intervention, which, by the way, it was given at a conference about like British media. And I was thinking, if I'd gone there as somebody in that industry, he shadowed DCMS and he wants to talk about his ridiculous Brexit position, I'd feel deeply insulted. Mm-hmm. You know, you're here to represent our interests, hopefully. I'd say this is a Labour member, obviously, but, you know, for them, potentially as the next Secretary of State responsible for the industry I care about that I work in. And you just want to... You want to make some weird narcissistic announcement that only Sky and the BBC covered, maybe only Sky actually covered, because of course you had so many other stories going on. So I think there won't be a bun fight. No, that said, I think that Tom Watson will try and create one. But what's happening is I think more and more MPs are realising that actually he's jeopardising their political careers. There are lots of, you know, decent centrist MPs who won't get deselected or won't be triggered because of these trigger ballots. Because they've not attacked Jeremy Corbyn for a couple of years, right? That's basically, look at Stephen Kinnock is a great example. I don't think he's a great centrist MP. I'm giving you the paradigmatic example.
The Vichy Labour, yeah. Travail, patrie, family, yeah. Work, family.
Yeah. I'm trying to give you the archetype. He's very right-wing, actually. I'm trying to give you the archetype of this kind of trajectory. Very critical of Jeremy Corbyn. Hasn't said a critical word, really, for 2 years. And what people like Tom Watson are doing is basically jeopardising maybe 100 of his colleagues like that, although it's a very different democracy, sort of pro-leave, respecting the vote, etc., who may be triggered because there's a general interpretation the parliamentary party is still on this collision course with the leadership, which is not that true. It's kind of true, but it's not that true. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a minority. Margaret Hodge, Wes Streeting, these kinds of people. And I think you have lots of other MPs who've been very quiet, generally sat on their hands, and are really worried that Tom Watson's interventions are actually jeopardising their careers. And so I don't think there'll be a bun fight over that. I think the big story will be climate change, mm-hmm. Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Yeah, Green New Deal, I think, will be the big story. Yeah,
and I mean, I think the thing that gets the Telegraph excited, that's like catnip for the right-wing press, is like private education, right? Mm. So there's
But this isn't new.
Yeah, no, not at all.
It was in the last election manifesto. That's what I don't quite understand.
Yeah, but you know, like it's the greatest hits thing, right? Corbyn's coming for your money. Corbyn's coming for whatever. It's like, yeah, okay, he is. But you know, I think you're right to say that there is... you know, that probably in terms of like the major policy stories at the Labour Party conference, there'll be these, you know, Green New Deal stuff, which I think is quite significant, right? And I think in some ways, you know, what will be interesting will be the way in which the motion gets. So there's this process called compositing, right? Where, you know, there's a meeting before it goes to conference, so they try and kind of, you know, get all the interest in the room and kind of change what's going on with the final motion that goes to the floor. There is a real question here about, you know, the relationship of some of the trade unions to Green New Deal stuff, right? And I think the Green New Deal campaign has been quite canny in like really foregrounding the way in which like the trade unions shouldn't be worried for their members if you know commitment to decarbonisation becomes a central plank of Labour Party policy, and I think that's important. I also think the unions have come an enormously long way on this in a relatively short space of time. Definitely still further to go, but you know there's going to be some natural kind of anxiety there about the way in which this is going to go. So I'm really interested to see what kind of motion actually makes it out at the end of the Green New Deal process, because I think that tells us a lot about the way in which the interests in the Labour Party are organised. I guess for me, the sort of flip side of this stuff is like, you know, going into the Labour Party conference this year, you think about the kind of way in which the incomplete revolution in the party has happened, right? And it really has been incomplete. And there has been this kind of fear of media drama, which I think is no, you know, it's not wrong to worry about media drama, right? Like it has impact on the way in which people think about the party. Oh, there goes the Labour Party again. Can't get it together. Mm. Can't fight, you know, can't find its backside with both hands. You know, there is that danger, right? But on some level, you've got to, you know, bite the bullet at some points. You know, the and I think of this most clearly in terms of kind of the reselection of MPs, right? You know, we're left with a process in which there is, you know, this very negative process, right? So in order to move to a selection process, you've got to campaign against the sitting MP. Mm. Labour Party members don't like negativity, right? Very broadly. They don't like...
People just generally... Yeah. It's easy to criticise somebody on Twitter or Facebook, but once you meet them face-to-face, you think, well, they've got... You know, that's a reasonable thing to say. They're a human being. Unless they do something absolutely appalling, which who's the lady in Hull, which is, she's been triggered?
Diana Johnson.
Diana Johnson. I mean, goodness knows how she's treating Labour. Or when Joan Ryan, for instance, called her entire CLP Stalinist trots.
Rabble of trots.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're going to probably be triggered. But generally speaking, I think generally speaking, people won't. I think it's been a massive, massive mistake. And the thing with what's happened with the enhanced trigger ballot process, you get the media downside anyway. Yeah. And then the person doesn't even get triggered. You know, it's not even about being deselected. There was a motion for a meeting of a branch about triggering, should we vote to trigger Keir Starmer? I don't think Keir Starmer should be triggered. I don't think he should be deselected. I want open selection for everybody. I think he's a perfectly good MP. And just that was like a story.
Yeah.
Just a motion on a piece of paper, which probably passed unanimously. And I just think, you know what? I almost prefer the old system. the old system. I mean, this is just a complete mess.
Yeah,
it's a complete mess because you're going to get people demonised in individual parties just for even talking about it. And it's, you know, I'm sorry to say it, it's a typically Corbynite compromise. I don't mean Jeremy Corbyn, I mean the movement around him. It's made compromises in the last several years, which I just can't understand. Like the IHRA, everybody's called anti-Semites for 6 months. They take a position on the IHRA, which everybody's called anti-Semites after that, and then they adopt it anyway. You know, but they had up to the IHRA well in advance. It was the examples that were the problem. So you see this time after time. You take the media hit and then you sort of do what you could have done 6 months earlier anyway. I don't really understand it.
Just nearing the end of the show, I mean, there are a couple of things at conference I'll be looking for as well alongside the Green New Deal. For me, housing. The housing policy of the Labour Party is still kind of very, very messy, very weird. So we'll see what comes out there. And the other thing, obviously, for me, we've been talking about it a bit today, and obviously it's an interest of mine, about the Labour Party's relationship to the transformation of British democracy. If there's ever a time to talk about it, it would be this year. So that for me is really big. But the big downer for me going into all this is like just in terms of the way in which the movement has built or failed to build, right? So I feel just a bit sad going into conference that I feel there's been so much parliamentary stuff, right? It's unavoidable to some extent. But so much concentration on high politics, stuff in parliament, even kind of policy concentrations, and much less on kind of building capacity for people to take action for themselves, whether it's trade unionists or in some other way. And it feels to me that a lot of that has been kind of lost. There are pockets where there's some kind of amazing stuff going on across the country, right? But a lot of it has kind of taken a back seat. It's obviously an old problem about electoralism, right? And I've been very hard on it before. I'm more of a compromising man these days. But you know, it is a real problem. I think there can be a synergy between the two, God knows there wasn't a flourishing street movement before. But, you know, without that depth, there's just a real concern to me that there's a kind of very precarious feel about the politics still within the Labour Party.
Yeah, and I think also... We're gonna see it at the World Transformed. You know, there is clearly look at all these left wing books that are coming out right now. Right, there was Grace's book out this week, doing very well. There's my book. There's Paul Mason's book. There's loads of books coming out this year. There's a very febrile intellectual atmosphere that surrounds the left. There's absolutely no doubt about that. To what extent is that translating into practical instantiations of collective action? You know, it's quite limited. Mm. And you know, I know you're doing this constitutional story time or something at TWT, right?
I am indeed, yes.
But there is, even now, there isn't really, there hasn't been an effective conversation about what do we want on the left in terms of transformation in the British polity and the British state over the next couple of years. It won't happen at this year's TWT. It probably won't even happen at next year's TWT. And it's just like, and you look at the formal institutions, you know, the Unlocked Democracy, the Electoral Reform Society, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not blaming anyone. You know, you can blame Navarra. How many articles have we done? Not as many as we could. But it does seem to me that general febrile atmosphere isn't feeding necessarily into very practical conversations other than the Green New Deal, where it's done precisely that. Mm. So let's do this thing. We'll achieve these ends. You know, there's several other areas where that hasn't happened.
Single sentence, last question. Definitely going to be a general election this year?
I wouldn't say definitely. I'd say highly likely.
Yeah, for me, I think extremely, extremely probable. You know, only way it doesn't happen is if Johnson somehow brings back a deal, passes it in the House. But even then, you think surely his party implodes. Can't govern until 2022 with a majority of one, even if everyone comes back, right? Like, I just can't.
And they said
it.
They wanted to do this Queen's speech, but the whole point of prorogue in Parliament, that won't pass. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining me today. We will be back same time in the same place next week. This has been Navarra FM on Resonance 104.4 FM, and we're very glad to be back after the summer. Speak to you soon.
This show is brought to you by Navarra Media. To find articles, videos, and more audio content like this, head to navarramedia.com. If you particularly enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen to it, why not head to iTunes? And as well as subscribing, leave us a review. Navarra Media can only exist thanks to subscribers and supporters. If you have the means, please consider subscribing at support.navarramedia.com. As well as helping us continue to produce regular content, subscribers will also receive priority access to events as well as promotions throughout the year. For regular updates, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Navarra Media, media for a different politics.